Good morning, Council. The next case on the court's agenda is Humboldt General Hospital and Sharon McIntyre, M.D. versus the 6th Ward and Kelly Barrett, Real Party in Interest, number 65562. You're in mid-trial, Council. We're sorry we imposed upon you, but we wanted to get this case argued, and I appreciate the short continuance by both of you.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Dominique Pallera, and I represent the petitioners, Humboldt General Hospital, and Dr. Sharon McIntyre in this case. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I could, Your Honors. The central issue presented in this case is whether the affidavit requirement set forth in 41A.071 applies to a cause of action pled as an intentional tort, here an alleged battery, where the underlying facts are indistinguishable from the provision of medical care. We urge this court to conclude that it does and to remand this case back to the district court with instructions to vacate its order, denying our motion to dismiss, and ordering that the court dismiss the complaint in its entirety without prejudice. Briefly, from a factual standpoint, back in March of 2011, the respondent, Ms. Barrett, approached Dr. McIntyre and asked if she would place an IUD for her. She was having problems with her other types of contraception. Dr. McIntyre spoke with the patient and got a written consent form signed by the patient to place a Mirena IUD. And in fact, subsequently placed that Mirena IUD. Approximately a year later, it was discovered through sources at the hospital that the IUD that had been placed in this patient had come through a Canadian distributor rather than a United States distributor. These IUDs are all manufactured in Finland. They are all manufactured at the same plant. They go to either Canada or to the United States. The only difference between these IUDs is the ones that come into the United States have a number on them that identify that they are FDA approved, but they are functionally identical. When this was discovered, the patient was sent a letter notifying her that this had been discovered, offering to either remove the IUD or replace it, and instead what Ms. Barrett decided to do was to sue Dr. McIntyre and the hospital, alleging negligence and battery, and the complaint did not have an expert affidavit attached to it. A motion to dismiss was filed on behalf of the petitioners on several grounds, including respondents' failure to comply with NRS 41A.071. The district court concluded that the negligence cause of action was one for medical malpractice and dismissed that cause of action. However, as to the battery cause of action, the court correctly concluded, in our opinion, that this was actually a cause of action for informed consent, but even though it had been pled as a battery cause of action, but in our view, erred when it declined to conclude that the affidavit requirement should be applied and thus allowed that cause of action to continue forward.
Let me ask you a question. Here in Las Vegas, I'm sorry, how did Judge Montero address that question that the battery was part and parcel of the medical malpractice as it related to informed consent as well?
Judge Montero found that it was an issue of informed consent. Court found that it arose out of the same circumstances, if I am recalling correctly. There were no separate facts that were alleged against Dr. McIntyre or the hospital. And in fact, what the court concluded,
paragraph 20 of the complaint itself alleges that the battery is essentially the product of lack of informed consent. Paragraph 20 says that Humboldt and McIntyre knew or reasonably should have known that Plaintiff Barrett did not consent to the implantation in plaintiff's body of said IUD, which lacked FDA approval for medical use. That's the third paragraph in the battery cause of action. So it's not a leap of faith that the district court would have said that this is based on informed consent as opposed to some intentional tort that the doctor struck the patient or some other activity that would create a battery.
Well, when you look at the complaint, Your Honor, you can see that common law elements of battery are not alleged in the complaint. There is no allegation in the complaint, for example, that Dr. McIntyre intentionally undertook to cause an offensive or harmful touching to the patient. And Judge Montero mentioned that in his decision that the common law battery was not pled and was not present, in his opinion. And we agree with that finding. And in fact, whether...
So your argument is that once the district court found that the basis for the battery was a lack of informed consent, then he should have applied the rest of the statute that says this is basically a requirement for an expert affidavit.
In part, yes. We conclude that is true. In fact, the court made a comment that it was not persuaded that the that we had shown that the affidavit requirement applied to that type of cause of action. But looking even at a more basic level, Your Honor, Nevada law is clear that one must look at the nature of the grievance to determine the character of the action, not at the form of the pleadings. And when the court examined that, when Judge Montero examined that, and when you look at the allegations in the complaint, clearly it arises out of the provision of medical care to this particular patient.
And Ms. Pallaro, my understanding of Nevada law, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is the only exception to the affidavit filing requirement is if there's an allegation of res ipsa loquitur in the complaint, then you don't, because there's a burden shifting and the affidavit's not required. Have there been any cases discussing informed consent, if that's some sort of exception like the res ipsa doctrine, to your knowledge?
There are not. And in fact, Your Honor, the case law has been clear for many years in Nevada that in fact this is a state where expert testimony is required to establish what is required to be informed or what is required to be told to a patient. In fact, when you look at the Beatty case from back in 1983, you look at the Smith case from 91, or you look at the Bronicki case, which was a chiropractor case, but again reaffirmed that in fact expert testimony is required to establish what a reasonable physician is to tell a patient. And so there is no exception.
What would you expect the affidavit to say about the FDA approval? Like, it's either approval or it isn't approval, and I guess the woman expected an IUD that had FDA approval. In other words, what more would you want in an affidavit?
Well, would an affidavit, sir, you know...
I believe that a declaration would have to include information such as the standard of care requires a reasonable physician to inform a patient about the status of FDA approval or not. The standard of care requires that a physician investigate whether this particular device is FDA approved, meaning this particular one, not the device in general, because we know that device in general was approved by the FDA, and that the standard of care requires that the physician inform that patient about that fact and give them the option. In this case, Dr. McIntyre did not know that this device was not FDA approved at the time. She was attempting to provide her clients with a less expensive IUD, and it was purchased through the purchasing department at the hospital. Unbeknownst to her, it came from a Canadian distributor rather than a U.S. distributor. So the declaration would need to address those types of issues. There are other FDA issues outside of this particular case where that might be extremely important.
Now, so, even if we affirm as far as the motion is dismissed, what about summary judgment? Couldn't you prevail on summary judgment this very easily on the battery issue?
On summary judgment?
Well, the Perhaps not, and very likely not, because the question would then come down to whether or not, you know, a patient would consent to this procedure, or they could find an expert at that point in time who might come in and say, well, no, the standard of care requires that the physician inform the patient of whether it's FDA approved or not. The whole allowing the case to go forward will vitiate the purpose of the statute, which is to stop these cases from the outset when they are not properly supported by an expert affidavit.
Let me ask you this, again in Las Vegas, I'm sorry, right here. The real party in interest has indicated that there was a claim for ordinary battery and that it was actionable as an ordinary battery, and that, in fact, in your answer, you had conceded that this battery claim exists outside the confines of medical malpractice and its statutory scheme. Can you address that and why it's significant? And I'm sure this goes back to your informed consent argument.
Your Honor, I don't believe that we conceded that this particular case is outside the context of informed consent. I would concede that there may be situations where a battery cause of action falls outside of a medical malpractice or a professional negligence cause of action, such as when there is,
right,
for example, a slapping of a patient, an unconsented touching of a patient. Clearly, when you look at the case law, and I don't believe there's any directly on point in Nevada, but when you look at other states such as California, and you look at Cobb versus Grant, for example, which was issued by the California Supreme Court a number of years ago, they do make a distinction between battery and informed consent. And I don't know if that's answered your question or not.
Well, and I guess what you've indicated is that you made a broad statement that didn't necessarily pertain to this case, and that's what was indicated in your answer.
Yes, Your Honor, and what I would say is that Respondent's Counsel, in their brief, seemed to suggest that we were conceding that this was a battery case, and nowhere did we do
right.
that. The other thing
okay,
I would point
you.
Out to the Court is that going back to this issue of looking at the nature of the grievance, determining the character of the action from what the underlying facts are, not from the form of the pleadings, is something that this Court has done repetitively. For example, recently in the Egan versus Chambers case, that came up where there were causes of action pled both in professional negligence and contract. And the Court in that case looked at that and stated, because both causes of action were based on an alleged failure to perform medical services, the entire complaint sounded in tort. So I will reserve the rest of my argument until Respondent is done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hendricks?
Jonathan Hendricks here on behalf of the Real Party in Interest. May it please the Court. I believe that there are three key items that we have to deal with here. And the first one is that the enactment of NRS 41A didn't abrogate the common law tort of battery that we're dealing with here. It enunciated specific rules for a protected class in negligence actions. Your Honor, you had raised the issue about whether or not common law battery, the elements were placed. In fact, in paragraph 5, we did have the touching that was unapproved. Consent is always a portion of any battery claim, because if you have the right to touch them or if they've consented, then it's not there. The other issue...
Well, wait, let me see if I think I misunderstood what you just said. The touching constituted part of the battery claim?
I think...
Is what you alleged in your complaint?
One of the issues that we dealt with is consent in there, but in any battery...
Correct, but even in an informed consent context, wouldn't there necessarily be touching if you're going to implant an IUD?
Well, yes, sir, I believe that there would be, but that actually goes to the last point that I was going to make. The petitioner's use of a non-FDA-approved device makes this simple battery action very easy. This isn't a medical sponge that's left behind or a piece of medical tubing. Rather, this is the equivalent of leaving a screwdriver inside the real party in interest. which wouldn't have been covered by any.
Doesn't that beg res ipsa?
Well, I think it's different, Your Honor, in regards to, I think that you can view this as a battery claim, because this wasn't an approved device. Therefore, it wasn't something that she could have consented to in the regular course of a medical consent, a regular medical consent.
Mr. Hendricks, yes, I'd like to take you back to the starting point about what type of battery we're talking about here.
Yes, sir.
In California, in Gorney versus Meany in Arizona, in a footnote, these courts recognize that there's a difference in the battery in the medical context. There may be a battery that is the product of a lack of informed consent, which, if it is, would be governed by the state's medical malpractice statutes, or a common law battery, as counsel suggested, an instance in which the physician or the nurse or the medical provider actually attacks or slaps or hits the patient as not part of some medical procedure. In this instance, part of the reason I referenced paragraph 20 of the complaint, you seem to be alleging that the basis for the battery here was the absence of informed consent with respect to the source of the IUD. Isn't that your contention?
I would say that is an element of a battery action that is pled, but I also believe that a simple battery action, without necessarily dealing with consent, because of the lack of this being an FDA-approved device, she couldn't have consented in a regular medical release because this wasn't a medical, it wasn't an approved medical device. And so on that basis, that means that just because she had signed a medical consent to have this done, this would take that outside of the medical malpractice. I would take it outside of the medical malpractice scheme that's provided specifically, because that's on negligence. But also importantly, because this couldn't be counted as a medical device, because it wasn't approved as a medical device. Now, counsel has made representation to the court about the interests of the defendant. I have an interest of the petitioners and the character of what this device is. That's not come out as far as what's been proven before the district court. There has been no evidence on that.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Would a orthopedic surgeon's operation on the right knee, when the left knee was the one to be operated on, constitute a battery, common law battery?
It would be different than the implantation of a device that's here, but yes, I believe that it would, Your Honor, because unless there was the consent said you could operate on either limb, it would be a simple common law battery because it was an action taken upon an area that was not consented to, and it was in fact done. Now, it might also be covered under NRS 41A as medical negligence, but it's different in regards to what we're dealing with here, in the fact that because this was a device that was implanted in, it would be as though they put in a different, some sort of knee replacement that wasn't in fact appropriate.
But I think that takes me to what Justice Perigary was asking. The physician who operates on the wrong limb, isn't that similar to the circumstance where you implant the wrong device? It's a res ipsa claim, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, you could obviously plead that, and you could make the argument to plead it in res ipsa, but I don't think it's limited to res ipsa. The fact is that what the defendant is trying to claim here is that it's exclusionary to only one type of item that's there. I think that it's perfectly appropriate to look at that as battery and do that and take it out of a negligence item. Yet, one of the things that has been dealt with in this is that when she relied upon Bronicky, and they talked about demonstrating negligence of the physician, the case was solely preceded on a negligence issue. So therefore, if we look at this as an intentional tort, this is a doctor who made a specific choice about what she was going to use, as we've pled, and the court is to take as given, and use something that wasn't approved.
I hate to interrupt you, but let me ask you this. I guess I'm struggling a little bit. Wouldn't 90% of the medical malpractice cases then become cases that include battery anytime there's a device that's used for an examination and the examination went wrong? it just, I'm wondering how you limit that.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think just using a device for an examination would do that.
What about an implant, any time there's an implanted part?
Well, Your Honor, if you're...
And something goes wrong, why isn't that a battery?
Your Honor, in this instance, it's a question about whether this should be considered a medical device. And according to the FDA, it wasn't. It was a non-approved medical device. So therefore, if it's a doctor who's using some device that isn't approved, then yes, it should be a battery. But if it's approved, it's a medical device and it would be appropriately found within the confines of medical negligence because it is a device that is not banned in this country.
Under your theory, would someone who undergoes a kidney transplant and receives a kidney that was not compatible be a battery?
An excellent question, Your Honor. I believe in regards to that, what they are consenting to in regards to that is a transplant of a kidney for what's there. I believe that the FDA has approved the transplant of kidneys. I don't think that it would be a certain type of what's there as opposed to what's there. But let's just say the FDA had banned transplanting kidneys and you put a kidney in, then that would no longer be an acceptable portion of medical practice. So it would not be, it would be covered under a battery under that instance. One of the things that other states have dealt with, including Tennessee, talking about in Blanchard, if it's an unauthorized procedure, constitutes a medical battery, separating those things from negligence to battery. If you're looking at this, this is something where I think that it's key to come back to the fact that this device that was used is to be presumed that the doctor knew that it was inappropriate and planted it anyway and caused the damages. It's a simple tort. Somebody did something to the real party in interest and caused her these damages. And it's not a question of negligence. And the real issue that we're dealing with here is what could that individual have done before that? And they could have dealt with it easily. The other thing that I would like to get back to on this, and this was the second point that I was going to make, we talked a little bit about NRS 41A, about the statutory consent scheme that they provided and what was issued there. I think there's a question outside the battery, if we come back to the initial dismissal of the negligence portion of this case, and I think that question is the fact that the doctor used a non-FDA approved device, is that appropriate to still be found within the restrictions of NRS 41A? Because this
where would it be otherwise?
Well, the fact is, as far as being required to have an expert declaration that's placed under that. So what I'm saying is, if you've chosen to use it's just like if you were using a drug that wasn't approved by that. Would that be, in fact, covered by the protections of the NRS 41A for a doctor who is doing that? Would it be somebody who was the unauthorized practice of law, unauthorized practice of medicine doing these kind of things? What I'm saying is that these are protections that are done for doctors that are supposed to be acting within their medical operations. So, in other words, using approved
device. Don't you need an expert affidavit to establish the standard of what is and isn't appropriate?
That's why I'm saying, Your Honor, I think that you can make the argument that, in fact, because this wasn't approved as a device, that is prima facie evidence that it was not appropriate to be utilized and therefore shouldn't be covered under NRS 41.
Wouldn't you need an affidavit of a professional in the field to say that device was not allowed?
I don't think that you would, Your Honor. The fact is that I think that you can make the argument that, in fact...
You're asking the court just to take public notice of that?
No, it was pled within the pleadings, so therefore it's something that can be brought out by discovery or any of the rest of it, and in a motion to dismiss this was provided by the petitioners. In fact, it would be assumed that it was not granted by the FDA.
But if what she said is absolutely correct, what the petitioner said, that the Canadian IUD and the United States IUD is the exact same thing that comes from overseas. In other words, there's no difference. That's where my summary judgment motion comes in.
Absolutely.
Where it will prevail on summary judgment.
We're not there, in fact, at the summary judgment motion. We're here at a motion to dismiss.
I know that.
And so the fact is the representation.
I'm trying to expand it just a little bit.
Right. The representation the council has made are her representations, but they aren't what are the facts before the court. The facts before the court is that, that it
was... Your theory is that it was unreasonable to implant in this young lady a non-FDA-approved version of this device, correct?
What I'm saying is that I have two items, Your Honor. One is that it was an intentional act to do this, and that's the battery claim.
Any surgery is an intentional act.
Negligence item, I would say that it was that it shouldn't be protected by NRS 41A because they were using something that they knew was not approved, and therefore they shouldn't receive the protections of that statute. They wouldn't be amongst the class of people who should be protected by them because they were using something that they knew was not an approved device. Just like as if they had opened her up and left a screwdriver inside of her. That wouldn't have been approved, and it should have been covered by them. That's why I'm saying...
Which goes back to Ray Simpson.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That goes back to the whole concept of Ray Simpson.
Well, Your Honor, and I think that that's fair, but what I'm saying
but
is...
But that's not your argument. You're not arguing Ray Simpson.
I'm not arguing
Ray Simpson.
What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is that they shouldn't be entitled to the defense, to the protections of 41, and this is outside the intentional battery claim. What I'm saying is that under the negligence claim that we brought forward, that they shouldn't be covered by NRS 41A because they were using something that they knew was not an approved device, and therefore they shouldn't be allowed to use the protections of
but
that device.
But as a precursor, you have to establish that fact that the device was not allowable.
At a motion to dismiss level, Your Honor, then we have established that because we pled it. And so if we were standing here at motion for summary judgment and we had not provided that, that's one thing. But we're not. We're at a motion to dismiss, and therefore but we have pled it, and therefore it is assumed to have been not approved and should be, in fact, allowed to proceed. I think both of these claims, both of the causes of action should be allowed to be put forward. I believe in regards to this, if you look to the fact that the facts that we have before us are we have a doctor who went forward choosing to implant a device that was not approved, and that causes repercussions, both as far as the protections that I believe that she can claim, but importantly about what the action she did and caused to the real party of interest occurred.
Counsel, do we have any obligation to consider the fact that the affidavit requirement was to hopefully hold down costs on medical malpractice cases by making sure that parties were in a position to prove the case opposed to allowing the parties to just go forward on their averment?
Your Honor, I believe that you absolutely have the obligation to follow that for the individuals and the actions that were covered by NRS 41A. The bottom line is that if they're not part of the protected class, or if the action isn't covered by the protected class, then it shouldn't be covered. They didn't abrogate the common law when they put in the statute. The statute doesn't say we are now moving forward and taking all of these different types of claims. They dealt with negligence. The statute deals with negligence. The legislature has never moved forward to say we're going to claim every type of action that's there. So what are we dealing with? We're dealing with people who fall within the statute that's there. And that, I believe, in honor, is what the proper use of the statutory language is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, artful pleading by a plaintiff to get around the requirements of the statute should not be permitted in this case. This Court has made it very clear that it will not countenance that in the Egan versus Chambers case when it saw that there were causes of action pled for professional negligence and for breach of contract. And you also found that in the Fairley versus Perez case where the Court noted in a footnote, I think it was footnote 8, that intentional and negligence-based medical malpractice claims are included in the affidavit requirement. Now, I understand that that case was overruled on other grounds, but that is still an appropriate observation by this Court.
What about a fraud case? Would you say that if a doctor misrepresented her credentials to perform surgeries, say she was board certified when she wasn't, and you went ahead with the surgery, would that be, and so the plaintiff sues for intentional fraud, would that be a subject to the affidavit requirement in 41A?
I believe it would be, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because you would require a physician who would have to say under oath that this is something that a reasonable person would want to know, or that a physician would be required.
No, I'm dealing
that
with an affirmative misstatement. I am board certified in neurosurgery, and indeed, you know, I have no certification at all. I'm a total fraud, and I operate on you and botch the job.
I still believe that the requirements of NRS 41A would require an affidavit in that situation, and to say otherwise would
undermine
the
affidavit requirement.
The statute. Yes, Your Honor.
What do you make anything of the legislature's recent repeal of 41A09 and its adoption of professional negligence in the broad term, using negligence? I don't think that would apply to your case, but is it indicative of anything to you?
Well, I think clearly what the legislature did in that situation is they made the definition of professional negligence, I think, exactly similar to that definition of medical malpractice.
But they renamed it negligence.
Yes, they did. And I think that they were trying to address the issues that came up perhaps in the Fearley and the Egan case. As you see that attorneys are trying to plead outside the requirements of the affidavit required for them to proceed forward.
So negligence means anything medical that is related to the procedure or the device.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and will be in recess.